wants of bringing Fergusoot. The danger lies in antagonizing them lords and states that isna involved as yet. A false step, and we'll be adding them to the enemy. He was upset, even talking in dialect. Johnny never thought he'd have to soothe Sir Robert. We have a chance, a good one. Now, here's what I propose we do. You go in there by yourself and do all you can. Sir Robert didn't much care for that, but he listened. And then, when you have finished or think you have gone as far as possible, you call me in. Introduce me however you please, but not too specifically. The communicator they've been using as host will do all the introductions, said Sir Robert. Well, tell him what I said, all right? Very good, laddie. I'll do whatever I can. And if I have not a ceasefire, I'll call you. The old war chief turned to leave. Good luck, said Johnny. Aye, lad, that's exactly what I'll be needin'. We're nae a-doin' weel at a' in the field. Johnny looked at his watch. It wouldn't be long now. Chief Chong Wan popped in, grinning.
The hole in the dam has stopped all but a trickle. My men are replacing the armor cable, patching and replacing it. The lake will be armored again before nightfall.
He threw his arms up, simulating the earlier explosion Johnny had made.
Boom!
He said, and vanished. Johnny thought, boom indeed. We'll all go boom if this conference fails. 7. Sir Robert had not been in the conference room 3 minutes before he realized that he was fighting the most difficult duel of his life. And he was in no shape for it. He had hardly slept at all since their return, and he recognized now that this was a huge error. For all his nickname, the Fox, he felt sluggish mentally. That nickname had been earned in physical combat and not in a conference room. Had this been a matter of troop dispositions and tactics, he could have coped with it. He would have laid an ambush for this Tallnap and transfixed him with arrows and hacked him to pieces with Lochaber axes. But there stood the Tallnap, elegant, poised, and deadly, already pressing Sir Robert back toward defeat. Sir Robert's morale was very bad. Half the anti-aircraft cover of Edinburgh had been wiped out by a desperate charge of Tallnap Marines. Russia was not answering at all, and his own wife was unreported after a cave-in of passages to the bunkers. It was desperate that he get a ceasefire. Yet this Tallnap was dithering around, posing, fiddling with his scepter, flattering the emissaries, and acting like he had all the time in the world. His name was Lord Slime. He had a tittering laugh that alternated with insidious acid hisses. He was a master of debate, much like a swordsman became a master of his blade.
"And so, my worthy colleagues," the Tallnap was saying now, "I really have not the faintest idea why this assemblage was convened at all. Your own time, your physical comfort, even the dignity of your august persons, representing as you do the most powerful lords of the universes, should not have been assaulted and insulted by an upstart lot of barbarians involved in a petty local dispute. This is a purely local affair, a minor spat. It involves no treaties, and so your presence was well known to be unneeded by this weak band of outlaws and rebels who seek to call themselves a government. I propose that we simply dismiss this gathering and leave it up to the military commanders."
The august body stirred, bored. And they were an august body. Jewels glittered on the breathing masks of some. Brilliant cloth rippled as they moved. Some even wore crowns as tokens of the sovereign power they represented. 29 arbiters of the fates of 16 universes, they were quite conscious of their power. They felt that if they so chose, they could flick this small and unimportant planet into eternity with no more than a careless gesture of a claw or fingertip. They were not really paying too much attention to Lord Slime, but tittering and whispering to one another, possibly about trivial scandals that had occurred since last they saw one another. They were evidence physically, of what happens when different genetic lines, moving up from different roots, became sentient. Off to the side sat the small gray man, another man, quite similar to himself, but with a better quality gray suit, had arrived. They were quietly watching Sir Robert. It was very plain they were not going to intervene or help further. Sir Robert loathed courtiers, weak and corrupt and dangerous. That had always been his opinion of this breed. His contempt, he counseled himself, must not show. "Shall we get on with this meeting?" he said. The emissaries stirred. They muttered responses. "Yes, let's complete the formalities. Must have come for something or other. Let's get it over and done with. I've a birthday party waiting for my pet lizard." A remark followed by laughter. They had all shown their credentials earlier, and these had been acknowledged by the group, all but Sir Robert's. Lord Schleim had seated himself off to the side, in front, where he could appear to be addressing them all as their leader.
"We have not actually examined the credentials of this soldier who called this meeting," he offered. "I move that he be removed as the principal speaker, that I be appointed in his stead."
Sir Robert offered them the disc. It was played. It was in Gaelic, a tongue they didn't know. And he might have been called ineligible to conduct the meeting, had he not looked beseechingly at the small gray man, and if one of the disinterested members had not asked the small gray man whether he had accepted these credentials. The small gray man nodded. Bored, the rest of them accepted the credentials. That one had been touch and go for Sir Robert, for just prior to his entrance he had gotten word that the chief of Clan Fergus had been wounded in repelling an attack on the guns, and he did not know whether he could get a confirmation from Edinburgh.
"I fear," said Lord Schleim, "that I must raise another critical point. How can we be sure that this upstart planet can afford even the small costs of convening such a meeting as this? Your lordships surely would not want to remain unpaid and have to bear such expenses yourselves. They guaranteed the diplomatic costs, but we have no way of knowing that they will ever pay them. A scrap of paper saying that one is owed does not fit well in the pocket."
The emissaries laughed at the joke, poor as it was. "We can pay," glowered Sir Robert.
"With scraps of dirty plates?"
said Lord Schleim. The emissaries laughed some more. "With galactic credits," snapped Sir Robert.
"Taken, no doubt," said Lord Schleim, "from the pockets of our crewmen. Well, never mind. Your august lords have a perfect right to declare that the meeting should proceed. But I myself feel it is demeaning for the representatives of such mighty and powerful sovereigns to meet just to determine the conditions of surrender and capitulation of some felons."
"Stop!" bellowed Sir Robert. He had had enough. "We are not here to discuss our surrender. Also, there are other planets than your own involved, and we have not heard from them."
"Ah,"
said Lord Schleim, with a leisurely, airy rotation of his scepter.
"But my planet has the most ships here, 2 for every 1 the other planets have. And the senior officer of this combined police force happens to be a Tallnep, Quarter Admiral Snowleater."
"Is dead," roared Sir Robert. "His flagship, the Capture, is lying right out there in the lake. Your admiral and that entire crew are carrion."
"Oh, so?" said Lord Schleim. "It had slipped my mind. These accidents happen. Space travel is a perilous venture at best. Probably ran out of fuel. But it doesn't alter what I have just said at all. Captain Rogo Dieter Snowl is the senior officer, then. He has just been promoted. So, it remains that the senior commander and the greatest number of ships are Tallnep, which leaves me in the position of principal negotiator for the surrender of your people and planet after their unprovoked attack on us."
"We are not losing," stormed Sir Robert.
Lord Schleim shrugged. He cast a negligent glance over the assemblage, as though pleading with them to have patience with this barbarian, and drawled,
Would the assemblage give me leave to confirm certain points?
Yes, of course, they muttered. Reasonable request. Lord Slime's head bent over the round ball atop his scepter, and with a shock Sir Robert realized it was a disguised radio, and that he had been in communication with his forces all along.
Ah, said Lord Slime as he raised his head, showed his fangs in a smile, and fixed his glass-hooded eyes on Sir Robert. 18 of your major cities are in flames.
So that was why they were burning deserted cities, to make an appearance of winning, just to terrorize and have a bargaining position in any surrender talks. Sir Robert was about to tell him those were just deserted ruins that hadn't been lived in for a millennium, but Lord Slime was pressing on.
This august assembly needs proof. Please have this trace run off.
He pulled a tiny thread from the base of the radio, a trace copy of the type they received from drones.
I will not do it, said Sir Robert.
The assemblage looked a little shocked. It began to dawn on them that maybe this planet's forces were losing.
Suppression of evidence, laughed Lord Slime, is a crime punishable by this body by fines. I suggest you mend your attitude. Of course, if you have no modern equipment.
Sir Robert sent the trace out to a resolver. They waited, and presently a stack of pictures came back. They were spectacular air views in full color of 25 burning cities. The flames were roaring thousands of feet into the air, and if you passed a finger down the right border, the sound turned on. The sound of rushing flames and crashing buildings cut through with a howl of furnace winds. Each picture had been taken at a height best showing the conflagration, and the resulting effect was devastating. Lord Slime passed them around. Paws and jeweled hands and inquisitive feelers made them roar.
We offer, said Lord Slime, very liberal terms. I am quite sure I will be rebuked by a motion of our House of Plunder for being so liberal. But my feelings of pity prompt me, and my word here is, of course, binding upon my government. The terms are that all your population be sold into slavery to meet the indemnities it incurred when Earth brought on this unprovoked war. I can even guarantee that they will be well treated. Over 50% survive such transportation on the average. Other belligerents, the Hovens, Jambit Chows, Bulbods, Drawkins, and Cairns, to divide up the rest of the planet to meet the expenses incurred in defending themselves against this unprovoked attack upon their peaceful ships. Your king can go into exile on Tallnep and even be provided with a spacious dungeon. Good, fair terms. Too liberal, but my feelings of compassion prompt them.
The other emissaries shrugged. It was obvious, it seemed to them, that they had been called here just to witness some surrender terms in a petty war. Sir Robert was thinking fast, trying to see a way out of this trap. At the start of the meeting, he thought he had heard the hum of the transshipment rig 2 or 3 times. He could not be sure. He could not count on anything right now. He was tired. His king was wounded. His wife might be dead. All he could really think of was leaping on this horrible creature and taking his chances with those poisoned fangs. But he knew such an action before these emissaries would be fatal to their last glimmering chances. Seeing his indecision, Lord Slime said with a harsh, acid hiss,
"You Earthlings realize that these mighty lords can make an agreement to force your capitulation? I believe the other combatants of the combined police force agree to my terms."
The representatives of the Hovens, Jambit Chows, Bulbods, Drawkins, and Cairns all nodded and said, one after the other, that they certainly agreed to these liberal terms. The rest of the assembly was just watching, a local dispute. But they could swing over and support the Tallneps if it meant ending this useless consumption of their time.
"I came," said Sir Robert, "to discuss your surrender. But before we go any further with this, I shall have to call in my fully authorized colleague."
He made a signal in the direction of where he knew the button camera was and sat down. He was tired. The slowness and delay of these deliberations had eaten into him. Didn't these gilded popinjays realize that while they dawdled about, good men were dying out there in the field? But urgency never touched them. They were not even really interested. He knew he had failed miserably. He hoped he had not hurt any chances Johnny might have. Forlorn hope. It was all up to Johnny now. But what could the poor lad possibly do? Chapter 27 1 Music began to be heard in the conference room. It was slow, dignified music, ponderous, impressive. The emissaries looked about with some interest, wondering what was going to happen. So far, this had been a deadly dull conference on an apparently deadly dull planet that didn't even have any nightlife or dancing or singing females to serve up. The conference had begun right away, as though there was something urgent or important to take up. Not even a customary round of hot spots to get acquainted. So far, no one had even offered any bribes. Instead, just some boring minor squabble that concerned combatants of just this one universe, and just a sector of it at that. Nice music, fit for regal functions, much less a conference. A huge man entered the door. He was about 6.5 feet tall, stripped to the waist, wearing a scarlet sash, with yellow skin, shaved head. It was one of the Mongols from among the Chinese. That in itself would not have been very interesting, but his muscles were huge and swollen with the effort of carrying something on his head that would seem to be very heavy indeed. But from all they could see, he was carrying nothing. There were his arms and gripping hands. There were his bulging back muscles and biceps. Although he was walking in cadence with the music, there was even a slightly perceptible tremor in his legs. But they could see nothing being carried. The man went up to the platform and with great care set the nothing down. They even heard a bump. It was a glassine electronics table used by cyclos for small electronic work that required light from every angle. It had been sawed down and sprayed with lens spray that passed light 100%, and so nothing reflected. He arranged the nothing with great care. There was a bit of a flurry in the audience as emissaries craned about and peered, amused and interested. The communicator, acting as host, he had a stripped-down mind radio in his ear, said,
"You have the solemn promise of this planet, at the risk of heavy indemnity, that no lethal, destructive, or harmful object will be entered into this conference room."
Several emissaries laughed. They were quite cheerful. A good joke to put nothing on the platform and then say it was harmless. It quite took their fancy. But something else was happening now. The huge Mongol had withdrawn. To the stately music, two beautifully gowned Chinese boys, faces impassive, came down the aisle. Each was carrying a gorgeous red satin pillow with gold tassels, and on each pillow was a huge book. Solemnly, first one, then the other, approached the host. He took each book from its pillow and laid it upon the heretofore invisible table, spine titles toward the audience. So there was something on the platform. An invisible table. New interest. Those with better eyes could read the titles on the spines up there. One was a dictionary of the Cyclo language, the other was Intergalactic Laws by Treaties of Governing Nations. But Lord Schleim, with his weak tallnap eyes, was not even trying to read any book titles. He was tense and crouching back. Theatrics. They were pulling theatrics on him. Ah, well. He would corner whoever this was and bite him to death with wit fangs. Sst! On theatrics. They would change nothing. The two boys withdrew in a stately fashion, carrying away their now empty pillows. The music suddenly stopped. There was a roll of drums.
Masters of all planets, lords of the great and powerful realms of 16 galaxies, may I now introduce to your august presence Lord Johnny, he who embodies the spirit of Earth.
A trumpet fanfare cut through and rose above the drums. The clear, piercing notes rose into the air. Johnny came walking down the aisle. He was walking slowly, heavily, commanding as though he weighed 1,000 pounds. He was dressed in black and silver, and he carried a silver wand. But it wasn't silver. It looked so, but when the light caught it, on the slightest movement, it flashed with blindingly bright rainbow colors. He came to the platform, stepped up, moved behind the table, and turned. At that instant, a mine spotlight placed just above the door flamed on. He stood there in black and silver, and yet a blaze of living color. He did not speak. Feet apart, not blocked from their view by the table, he held the silver wand between his two hands and simply looked at them with a stern and even disdainful expression. Dominant. This was impressive enough to the emissaries. Even though they were used to pomp and tended to discount it, they would have been respectful of this display. But there was something else. The beast on the helmet. It looked alive. The trick of the light, the play of the silver metal that flashed, the glowing red coals of eyes. Whatever it was, it looked alive. Was he wearing a live winged beast on his helmet? Lord Schlime would have none of it. Unfortunately, there had been a slight slip which played directly into his hands. When one word meant several things in Cyclo, it required a slight change of inflection or tone to make it have the different meaning. The word spirit in Cyclo could also mean mind, angel, or devil, and although the communicator had used the right inflection for spirit, Lord Schlime chose to accept a different inflection. The Tallnep sprang up as though striking from cover.
"Lords and august emissaries," he said with an acid hiss, "I challenge the right of this devil to speak. We have seen no credentials. We..."
"Sir," said Johnny, "I could not quite hear you. What did you say?" Lord Schlime whirled on him. He began savagely,
"I said..."
"Ah, yes, yes, yes," said Johnny, waving his wand. "I beg your pardon, your lordship. It was merely your uncouth Tallnep accent. Quite provincial. Can you understand him, my lords?" They laughed. It was true that Schlime had a bit of an accent, due probably to his fangs and having to hiss. Tallneps were really quite rural. They had only one planet, and that was quite distant from the center of things.
"You devil," hissed Schlime.
Said Johnny. "No violence in such a meeting. I am quite certain I, nor the truly worthy emissaries in this gathering, desire your ejection from it." Then, before Schlime could retaliate, something else happened. The wand, which had been tapping Johnny's palms, suddenly pointed in the direction of Schlime's feet. It had a small beam of light set in the end of it, and it flashed on. It was a light used to show dust in a mine shaft, and it made a very thin white pencil of light, like a pointer. Johnny looked a bit incredulous. Then he turned his head clear off to the side as though to hide a laugh. The light switched off. Schlime looked down. He had to stretch, for he had a bit of a paunch. What had this devil seen? Then Lord Schlime saw them. His boots. Instead of wearing his proper scaled, glittering green boots, he was wearing old, rough blue boots. Dirty blue boots. His valet. In the rush of getting him off, his clumsy, damned valet had put the wrong boots on him. Oh, when he got home. When he got home, he would have the oaf punctured. Worse, dragged through the streets and bitten to death by small children. But Johnny was addressing the emissaries. "I must apologize to you, my lords. I pray you to overlook my discourtesy in arriving late. But I am sure you will understand when I tell you that I was looking for a point of law." He looked at them in a kindly and deferential fashion, laid down the wand on the invisible table, and tapped the top of the law book. The manners and phrases of the old Chinko instruction discs were coming in handy now. At first, when he entered, he had felt stiff and unnatural, artificial and affected. But suddenly, it felt as though he had been doing this sort of thing all his life. "No one," he continued, "could possibly expect such noble and such highly titled and credentialed lords to experience an uncomfortable trip, nor to convene upon such a lowly and undeserving planet, for the petty purpose of adjudicating the minor differences of some back-planet squabble. The delegates sat up. This was more like it. This is what they had been thinking all the time. Hear, hear. Sir Robert was thunderstruck. What was this lad up to? The war not important? Their strong points caving in, their friends dying, and he could say it wasn't important? He looked at the two small gray men. They were both sitting there smiling, a bit vacant, but smiling. They hadn't been smiling before, and Sir Robert knew for a fact that Johnny hadn't talked with them, so they knew no more than he. But he had to restrain himself from jumping up to cry out that this was an important war. One point. These emissaries in their jewels and flashing clothes, strange faces and feelers, were all bobbing their heads and settling down for a real conference. No, continued Johnny, it would be an insult to the mighty states you represent to call you here on something as trivial as repelling pirates. Lord Schleim started to slither up out of his chair. He was about to shout this devil down and force him to mend his language when he saw those eyes looking again at his boots. But it wasn't really the glance at the boots that stopped Lord Schleim. He recognized, with diplomatic shrewdness, that this devil could fall into a trap of his own digging. It was a very simple matter to prove that the attacking Tolnep ships were fully commissioned legal ships and officers of the Tolnep Navy. So let the devil plow on for now. He'd fang him shortly. Ha! The fellow was no real opponent after all. Such regal representatives of kings and governments, continued Johnny, should, and if I am wrong, please correct me, convene on real points of treaties and intergalactic law. And on these their expertise cannot be seriously challenged or questioned. Hear, hear. True. Naturally. You have a point. Pray continue. The emissaries, all except for the combatants, were sitting up, interested. And all combatant representatives began to look uneasy. All except Lord Schleim, who was beginning to feel confident. This devil was going to dig a hole for himself. There was one trouble here for Lord Schleim. Each time that devil moved, it made lights flash off his buttons, and Tallnaps had to wear filters to convert to ordinary visible spectrum. So every flash of a button overwhelmed the power of the filter, and he was getting a headache. He wished he could make them turn off that spotlight they had on this creature. Johnny was sweeping on. The definition of the category of pirate as opposed to the definition of military force is a critical question. I am sure that from time to time, even in the best organized, paid, and regulated military forces, elements of navies or even merchant ships have mutinied or gone astray or been misled and have turned pirate, defying the benign and responsible authority of their own governments. Oh, yes, many instances. Just last month, in these troubled times, a squadron of spaceships had mutinied at Oxentab. Lots of them in history. An old point, the emissaries agreed. Lot of stories written about it. Go on. So, continued Johnny, to protect legitimate authority, such as that which you represent, pleased faces except for the combatants, and to really be able to cope with piracy when it occurs, the definition must be clarified. And this can only be done by an august body such as yours in the form of a formal treaty. Good idea. Correct. Right. Very glum combatants, except Schleim, who was certain now this devil would shortly be sent down in flames. Johnny opened the Cyclo dictionary to a marked place. We know that the Cyclo language is a composite of many tongues, even your own individual languages, and was not in fact a language generated solely by the Cyclos. It is a universal tongue because it was taken from many universes, which is the only reason we so generally speak it. That was true. Real scholarship. The Cyclos picked up everything from others, including language. Shouldn't even be called Cyclo. The emissaries buzzed about it. This dictionary, said Johnny, is the standard recognized work, is it not? He held it up. Yes, they nodded. Johnny laid the book down and read from it. It states, pirate, one who preys upon commerce or communities or planets in a vessel or spaceship or group of ships not under the regulation of a national or planetary government. Also, any commander or crew member of such a ship. Right, right, that was a pirate. But Lord Slime was feeling very smug. He felt he really had this devil now. He could see exactly which way he was trying to go. It would be child's play to fang these arguments to pieces and then proceed with the surrender talks. What a letdown the devil was going to get. Every Tallnep ship was under the direct orders of the Tallnep government. Totally legal. Johnny had turned to the book on intergalactic law. However, according to treaties, of which intergalactic law is composed, we have a different definition. With your permission, I will read it. Article 234,352,678. Based on the treaties of Cyclo versus Hoven, signed at Blanc, Cyclo versus Kamchad, signed at Cyclo, a pirate shall hereinafter be defined as one who feloniously steals or mines minerals. Johnny tapped the book and laughed lightly. I guess we know who and how and why that misdefinition occurred. They laughed. Cyclo was not very well liked, and a Cyclo would pass anything to protect Cyclo interests. Therefore, said Johnny, this august body, I feel, should define pirate and piracy among systems and planets, and, after due deliberation, envisage the execution of treaties to forbid it. Sir Robert groaned. The lad was proposing days of wrangling over stale things like treaties when the planet was being torn to bits with a flat-out assault, undoubtedly egged on by this Tallnep through his hidden radio. But his groans were drowned in the general assent. Johnny had now drawn back from the books. He took up the wand. He tapped it in his palm. I feel, in my humble opinion, he certainly didn't look humble, that we must work upon this now in order that we should know whether the Tallnep fleet officers and crewmen are to be slowly vaporized individually as pirates or simply shot as military men when court-martialed. Lord Slime slithered up with a scream. Stop! He glared around at the other combatants. They just sat behind him. They were saying nothing. They simply looked stunned. Then he realized that the devil had said Tallnep. He had not said combined forces. Venom splattered as Lord Slime hissed his protest. The devil had gone too far. In a moment, Lord Slime would tear down his house, but just now there was another point. You are selecting out the honorable Tallnep forces for your venomous insinuations, said Slime ravingly. This is a clear case of prejudice and has to be dismissed as such by this body. There are other combatants. I demand these statements to be stricken from our recorders as biased, slanted, and an intentional insult to the Tallnep planetary forces. Johnny calmly smiled at him and looked at the Tallnep boots and back up to the fanged face. Bombastic conduct will right no wrongs here. Your conduct insults these lords. Behave yourself.
I demand a reply, screamed Slime.
Johnny sighed tolerantly. Very well, you shall have it. It is my opinion that the Hovens, Bulbods, Drawkins, Jambit Chow, and Hockner forces were simply coerced, probably with false statements, into cooperating with the Tallneps. Since by your own testimony your ships vastly outnumber theirs, and since your own senior officer, as you state, commanded the so-called combined force, and when killed was succeeded by another Tallnep, who is now their senior officer, it seems very evident they were forced to cooperate in this attack by the superior firepower of the Tallnep fleet. So we cannot hold these other races or forces guilty, and we are not charging them. They are only victims, and cannot be regarded, in my opinion, in any other way when we apply the word pirate on a clarified definition. Now was the time. Lord Slime knew the ripe moment when he saw it. He would crush this devil. He slithered himself up to his full height. He assumed the grandeur of dignity.
Your arguments, devil, drop into the rocks and fall like dust into the grass.
the Tallnep Admiral and the Tallnep Captain and all the Tallnep ships and crews were never in any way acting outside the command of the Tallnep Central Government. So, enough of this claptrap about pirates, and let us get on with the proper business of surrender.
The taste of triumph and victory was sweet as poison in the Tallnep's mouth. In a few moments now, this whole thing would be finished. Sir Robert groaned. He saw the two small gray men were looking down, nervous now, regretting, perhaps, they had helped. Two. Johnny looked at the Tallnep. He shook his head sadly. He looked at the assemblage. They were leaning back, beginning to lose interest. For a while there, it had appeared that something would occur that would concern them. "My lords," said Johnny, "please do forgive this distraction from the main purpose of this meeting. This Tallnep is absolutely demanding that we finish this minor concern of a raid upon a peaceful planet. So, with your permission, I feel I have no other choice than to settle this slight disturbance." "Yes, so well, go ahead. One doesn't see where this is going now, but go ahead. I suppose the Tallnep will just keep interrupting, so go ahead." Johnny sighed. "Thank you, your lordships. You are very tolerant." Then he turned to Lord Slime. Johnny took a very firm stand with his feet. He had picked up the wand and was now tapping it in his palm. "Lord Slime," said Johnny, "for I believe that is what some call you, please produce the orders given to your admirals and captains." Slime laughed.
"You know very well an emissary cannot carry with him the whole files of a military establishment. Furthermore, although you, as a barbarian, would have no inkling of this, a Tallnep commander is at liberty to exercise autonomy on military expeditions."
"As I suspected," said Johnny. "There were no legal orders."
"I did not say that,"
hissed Slime. "I'm afraid you did," said Johnny. "I have no choice now but to proceed, for you are delaying more important proceedings." Johnny smacked the wand into his palm twice. It sounded like two pistol shots. There was an instant rush down the aisle as two uniformed technicians came, pushing a mine cart. The cart had been plated in gold. It looked very sleek. On it rested a projector of some size, and it too was gold-plated. It was an atmosphere screen projector. Its general use was to project pictures of mine shafts or tunnels. It used a projection light based on the same principle as an atmosphere armor cable, with a variation. The light, striking atmosphere ions, made them condense to greater or lesser degree and reflect back. By putting a stick for scale in the original scene, one could then take the projected picture and actually measure distances in it from point to point. It put, in this way, a three-dimensional picture on thin air. The technicians moved it into a place where it would project into the large, empty space to Johnny's left. They placed a multiple-button switch on the invisible table close to Johnny's hand. They bowed, about-faced, and withdrew. They had come in so fast and left so quickly that Lord Slime had not had time to get in an objection. Now he did.
"I must protest this display of foolish flimflam. I will not permit you to hoodwink this august body further."
"Slime," said Johnny severely, "it will do no good for you to seek to suppress evidence when you well know it will work to your disfavor." Mutters from the emissaries.
"Sit down, Slime. Be quiet. This looks like it will be interesting."
"Hush, Slime."
Johnny pressed two buttons. The spotlight at the door went out, and simultaneously a picture flashed on it. It was a three-dimensional, remarkably detailed close-up of Rufe Arsabagger. He seemed to the emissaries to be standing right there in what had been empty space. There was no sound. But they had never before seen a mine atmosphere projector, for the simple reason that the Cyclos never marketed entertainment gadgets, and this was mining equipment. Rufe Arsabagger's face was patched with the sores of disease. His fangs were black, and one was broken. He was dressed in something that looked like it had been discarded from a slum. It was part of a long series of pictures shot by pilots flying air cover at the Purgatoire River. It had been taken with a radio telephoto camera. The shots had been left in Johnny's room to help do the briefing of the time he had been out of action. Johnny said, "Is this man a member of your government? Now answer carefully, Schleim. Is this a minister of any department, an official of the military?" Several emissaries tittered. The figure was so disgusting that if this were a member of the Talnap government, well... Schleim was stung. He looked at the picture. What a disgusting creature. Vomitous. Eyes still dazzling a little bit from the lights flashing off the devil, he pawed at his filter and stared again. Was there something vaguely familiar about that figure? That he was peering so hard made it seem that maybe the Talnap government was composed of such riffraff. Several emissaries laughed out loud. That did it. Schleim lashed out, "Of course not. That filthy creature would be thrown out of any government department on Talnap. You are insulting me. You are insulting Talnap. You are running a calculated campaign to degrade the dignity and importance of my office and my planet. I must protest."
"Quiet," said Johnny soothingly. "Just pay attention here. You have said he is no part of your government and has no official capacity. Is that right?"
"Absolutely. If you think..."
"Then," said Johnny, "what is he doing giving orders to Quarter Admiral Snowleader?" He pressed another button. The camera seemed to draw away. Motion occurred in the scene. The bridge of the capture came into view, along with the diamond with the slash, the Talnap insignia. And there was Quarter Admiral Snowleader facing the horrible creature Roof Arsebogger. Johnny touched another button. Sound came on. The rumble of a capital, non-atmosphere ship as picked off the vibration of its bridge window glass was clearly penetrated by the voice of Roof Arsebogger.
"You must act independently, Snowleader. You must do whatever gives you the best chance of private profit. What I am telling you to do is rush on down to that base and grab it all for yourself. Once you have this planet under your personal control, you can tell everybody else to buzz off and be damned. Smash the place. Seize the people and sell them for your own profit. I will cover you, and like it or not, that is what you must do. The power is mine, and we will split the profits. Understood?"
Snowleader was smiling. He touched his quarter admiral's cap in a salute.
"I am at your orders."
Johnny hit another button. The camera seemed to draw further away. It showed the whole combined force in the sky over the Purgatoire River. The sound was off.
"That is your admiral. That is your fleet." Johnny hit a pair of buttons. The picture was gone and the spotlight back on. The emissaries were enthralled. They had never seen atmosphere projection before. It was like looking at a totally live scene. Yes, that was the Talnap fleet, all right. That was the admiral. Schleim's attitude said clearly it was. Suddenly, Lord Schleim exploded.
"Doctored pictures. Anyone can doctor recordings. This so-called evidence..."
"Oh, come now, Schleim," said Johnny. "Bombast and hysteria won't cancel this. The pictures were too clear to be doctored, as you call it." He turned to the emissaries.
"So you see, your lordships, the Talnap admiral was not acting under the orders of his government, but under those of a private individual. He was acting for personal profit and not for his planet. Be quiet, Schleim. You can't cover up evidence with shockingly bad temper. My apologies for his conduct, my lords. One can sympathize with his position. This Quarter Admiral Snowleader, by the way, is the uncle of Half-Captain Rogo Dieter Snowl, and was brought into the venture by his nephew according to disks and traces we have available. It was a family matter, and the piratical venture is obviously being continued by the nephew. Johnny did not tell them there was a lot more in the views just shown, which did not necessarily carry out his point. but very clearly Ruf Arsabagger had been the one to egg the Admiral on. "So the point of piracy," said Johnny, "has been proven. Here we had a fleet operating by another authority from that of its government. If you will indulge me a moment longer, I will simply ask this slime for the surrender of those ships, and then we can get about our more appropriate business of piracies and treaties. Slime, will you please call whoever is in command now and tell him to gather his ships in a meadow I will name?"
"You must be mad," screamed Slime. "Our fleet is in full command of your skies, and you ask us to help end a pirate venture."
Johnny finished for him. "My lords, forgive me, but this Slime is going to occupy a little more of your valuable time before you are rid of him. With your permission, we will complete this odious business."
"Yes, yes. By all means, go ahead. We can take up the treaty later." They agreed.
The combatant planet emissaries were looking at one another, a bit frightened. What had they gotten themselves mixed up in? The small gray man looked less hangdog. But Sir Robert, studying Slime, knew he was far from finished. He was using the moment to hiss into his radio. He was giving orders, something about making suicide crashes. He must be a bit rattled, for he was speaking cyclo. Sir Robert excused himself and stepped quickly over to operations to tell their forces what was going on, to tell them to be alert, to double their efforts to fight back. The first small gray man slipped out and passed an order to his ship to turn on two red lights and change the radio signal to "Alert, alert, an interplanetary intergalactic conference is taking place within this area. Any capital ship or vessel of any kind entering this zone will be branded an intergalactic outlaw and its government or owner subject to all penalties that can be imposed. Alert! Alert! An interplanetary intergalactic conference is..." 3. Lord Slime was not the least bit rattled. He knew exactly what he was doing. He was now applying a maxim of diplomacy which stated that when diplomacy failed, one resorted to military means. It had become obvious to him in these last few minutes that if he continued along the previous course, he would lose. So he had shifted his entire planning suddenly and irrevocably. These were very troubled times. He felt the power of the small gray man had crumbled, and that things were not what they used to be. Therefore, any threat of retaliation from the small gray man could be ignored. This was the first emissary meeting in over a year, and he was completely certain that the power of the emissaries and collective governments had become a shadow that was no real danger to Talnep. These empires and states were too far away. He had just given half-captain, now Captain Snarl, just today, very specific orders. He had used a word code known only to officers of flag rank and executives high in the Talnep government. Using one set of words, one could convey quite another meaning. Additionally, the radio band used was hyper-non-directional, known only to the Talneps, and could not be picked up on any other radio except those used by flag officers and the diplomatic service, a band which was constantly running on the bridge of every Talnep major war vessel. And if that weren't safe enough, the transmissions were also scrambled. Slime had just ordered Rogo-Dieter Snarl to send the ships of other combatants to the terrestrial points being defended by the Earthlings, to gather up all Talnep forces, and to proceed with all speed to the conference location. He had told Snarl to totally disregard any and all conference warnings of the small gray man. Since the bulk of the Talnep vessels were at Singapore, a little over 4,500 miles away, quite close, really, they would arrive over this spot in about 2 hours. Slime had, in the bottom of his scepter, on the opposite end from the radio, a paralysis beam. All he had to do was give the end of it a twist, and every person or creature within hearing would become instantly paralyzed, except himself. A tap on his own ears first would close his deaf flaps. This entire conference was at his mercy. All he had to do was get them all outside in the bowl on some pretext, so that any and all guards were also within hearing distance. Listen for the first signs of the arrival of his fleet, tap his own ears, and twist the bottom of the scepter. Tolnep diplomats were chosen for bravery as well as wits. He would pick up a gun and shoot his way to the switches of the armor cable, if necessary, turn it off, and let his fleet marines in. As to this teleportation console, he really couldn't care less. Tolnep would be better off if it were destroyed. A nation that based its economy on slavery was always under some kind of threat, and this teleportation had interfered with Tolnep far more than it had helped. He himself was within flying distance of home. The other combatants were also, and would have to bow to his commands or be killed. As for the rest of these emissaries, how they got home, if ever, was no concern of his. And dead emissaries and a dead litter of terrestrial personnel told no tales, especially when buried. He would, of course, go through the motions of torturing this devil and try to get the teleportation design out of him. If the devil died in the process, it did not matter. But the cream of the jest was that, if anything went wrong, he would use the devil's own arguments to defend himself. He would claim that Rogo Dieter Snaul had turned pirate, that he had acted contrary to orders, and that his approach to this conference was an outlaw act. He knew he could depose and execute Snaul and still command the Tolnep crews. Snaul would simply be sacrificed for the greater good of the state, a common expedient in such diplomatic circles. Schleim could even mop up the other belligerents using the Tolnep fleet, if it came to that. It was very neat planning. The only thing he had to solve now was how to get this entire conference out into the bowl. He was now feeling so confident he was hardly even listening to this devil as he resumed his actions. Whatever the devil did would be useless, without avail. Tolerantly, Lord Schleim sat back and lent half an ear to the continuing proceedings. Diplomacy was indeed quite an art, but if it failed, there was always force. He fingered the bottom end of his scepter. He tuned the rest of his hearing in to catch the first rumbles of his fleet in the sky. 4. There had been a delay while a technician changed the cartridges in the atmosphere projector. The emissaries, seeing that Johnny was again about to speak, settled down. "My lords," said Johnny, "I do appreciate your indulgence in permitting me to clean up the remaining bits of this odious Tolnep matter. Indeed, I'm impressed by your patience. I assure you we may soon be able to proceed with the legitimate concerns of such an authoritative group." The influence of the polite instruction discs of the Chinkos was coming in very handy now. These lords, except for the combatants, were definitely on his side. Johnny stood tall in the mine spotlight. His buttons flashed. The dragon on the helmet seemed to move as he turned his head to Lord Schleim. "Tolnep," said Johnny, with disdain and contempt in the word. "I have some views that were taken while the conference was verifying credentials. I'm going to ask you to identify certain things for me." Schleim sat back easily, quite composed now.
"Go ahead, devil," he said almost airily.
Johnny looked at him closely. What had caused this sudden calm? Was it just an exhibition of diplomatic supercontrol? Schleim was, after all, a clever and well-trained diplomat. With a deft touch of switch buttons, the mine spotlight went off, and a new view appeared, filling all the empty space in the room to Johnny's left. It was a remarkable shot. The emissary sat up and peered, very interested. There, just as though seen from the port of a spaceship, bright and clear, projected in three dimensions, upon the empty air, was the whole system where the Tolnep planet rode in the ninth ring. The huge combination sun, a double star with the small companion circling the larger orb, shed its double-shadowed light upon the vast system of planets and their moons. The name of the system was Batafor in the cyclo-coordination books, Sirius or the Dog Star in the ancient man constellation charts. "Is this Batafor?" Johnny asked Lord Schleim.
The Talnep laughed.
If you took the shot, you should know what it is. Why ask me?
Johnny searched out the Hoven in the second row with his wand as a pointer. Perhaps the regal emissary of the Hovens might care to assist us.
Is this the Batafor system?
The Hoven had been regretting his involvement in all this for some time. His nation was a traditional enemy of the Talneps, and had suffered much in times past from their slave raids. He had begun to suspect that there were penalties and reparations coming up sometime soon. This spirit of Earth seemed to have been taking pains to exclude the other combatants, and he had seen a possibility of escaping censure if it all went wrong here, as it definitely seemed to be doing. Best curry some favor. He could see no danger in it. He rose and came forward, and Johnny handed him his wand with the pointer beam turned on. The Hoven waved the beam generally across the system.
I recognize under test this is indeed the Batafor system. That is the old cyclo name. We locally call the double sun Twino, which stands for mother and child in the Hoven tongue.
He tapped the planet ring nearest the sun.
This is Jubo, uninhabited due to its extreme heat and gravity pulls.
He pointed rapidly to the second, third, fourth, and fifth rings.
These have names but are not important. Uninhabited, for they are subject to earthquakes and volcanic upheavals.
He tapped the sixth ring, the planet almost hidden behind the double sun.
This is Tortut, a cyclo-mining planet. It had a population once, but they were annihilated.
The Hoven looked inquiringly at the Hockner.
My lord, do you mind if I go on?
The Hockner shrugged, then gave a strained laugh.
As you have already as much as said so, my dear colleague, you may tell them it is a possession of Hockner.
Very good,
continued the Hoven.
This seventh planet is Holoban, part of the Hockner Confederacy. The eighth planet is Balor, one of our own Hoven planets.
He lowered the beam and looked at Lord Slime. But Lord Slime simply shrugged and said,
You make a very fine astronomy lecturer, Lord of the Hovens. You have omitted some of the fauna and flora, but go ahead.
The Hoven put the pointer on the ninth ring.
And this, I can attest, is Talnep.
He peered more closely.
Yes, these specks about it are the five moons, though one is hidden from this angle. Talnep is remarkable for its moons in a system where planets seldom have more than one. The reflective quality of these moons is a bit remarkable due to their composition. The double sun can give out the normal light spectrum, but on reflection from these moons, the light shifts upward in the spectrum. The Talnep civilization prefers to work by moonlight and normally sleeps in the direct sun. It is said they are not indigenous.
Oh, spare us, spare us, said Lord Slime. You will be telling us about Talnep egg mating next. Keep it clean, Hoven.
Some of the uninvolved emissaries laughed. Slime was wriggling his way back into their good graces.
The tenth planet, the Hoven went on, is a cyclo-mining planet, Tung. The population existed once, but had actually been removed by the Talneps before cyclo-occupation. The 11th...
Thank you very much, Lord of the Hovens, said Johnny. You have been very helpful. The Hoven stepped down and would have gone back to his seat, but Johnny checked him. Johnny hit another button. A clear view of the city magically appeared in the air. It was just as though one were suspended in space well above it.
That is Kreeth, said the Hoven, the Talnep capital, very distinctive. See how the streets wind their way and entwine.
He came back up and took the pointer.
This is the House of Plunder, their legislative center. See how its sections wind around and come back together. Unmistakably Talnep in its architecture. This is Grath, their famous combined public park and slave auction center. this rock hill with the holes in it.
Thank you, said Johnny. And now, this is what I really want you for. He pushed a button and the picture changed. It swooped down at the park and gave the emissaries the feeling they were free-falling in space. The park stayed still, but all the surroundings swooped sideways and away, making it look for a moment like a bowl. The camera had steadied. The view now showed